We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. At the controls this morning, Jason Croft. Harriet Williamson is our producer. This morning in this hour, we'll be doing the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. And for some time now, he's been here with us on a Monday every other month. And we open up the phone lines and say, okay, if you have a question about your health or someone who is close to you, you can call, and the doctor will do his best to give you an answer with the usual caveats about not being able to do diagnosis over the phone. We do the show to be a resource for you. So if you have a question, he sees people of all ages in his practice, adults and children. He's even been known to deliver babies. So if you have questions about just any of that, anything, you give us a call. He'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email if you'd like, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Good to be back.
Is it still, if someone has not yet gotten a flu shot, is there still benefit if you go out and get one now?
If you haven't gotten the flu yet, get your flu shot.
And you were just talking a little bit earlier. You were saying that so far, in terms of what you've seen with flu, not too bad.
Nope. The peak of the season is probably yet to hit, but it's actually, and I hate to say it out loud, been pretty quiet from an influenza standpoint so far.
Okay. And in terms of things that, we've certainly talked about this before, but maybe it would be good to just review, in terms of the most basic things that you can do to try to stay healthy and not get cold or flu. It's a fairly short list, I think, actually.
It is. And as it relates to influenza, it's get your vaccination. As it relates to other viral illnesses, try and keep your hands away from your mouth and nose. Wash your hands frequently. In general, if you can avoid other folks who are ill, you will simply minimize your chances of acquiring illness. And then the basic things that, mom told you to do in terms of good health, eat well, get plenty of sleep, maintain in general your immune system in good shape. Now, there are obviously patients who have medical conditions where their immunity is somewhat suppressed, and they're going to be even more highly susceptible to infection, and they need to be even more diligent about trying to minimize their exposures.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people are always told is a standard sort of thing to do when you have a cold is be well hydrated, plenty of fluids. And basically, I guess that could be herbal tea. It could be water. Good things, healthy things.
Not beer.
Not beer. Is there any preventive that goes with that? Just making sure that you maintain a good level of fluid intake, or is that mostly after?
It's mostly after. In general, if you're a little on the dry side, the mucus secretions that are produced when people have the cold virus are thick and sticky. It makes you more uncomfortable. It becomes a place where other organisms then can grow. So in general, staying hydrated is a way to make sure that the mucus remains thin and easily drained out so that you can get rid of it. Mm.
Some people believe a lot in supplementing certain things, and maybe the big thing that people think of is vitamin C. There have been from time to time people have made this argument that taking big doses of vitamin C is either good for preventive or to, help fight a cold. Is there really much evidence that supplementing any more than 100% of the RDA is going to do anything for you?
It really hasn't. So, you know, to the extent that somebody wants to take their vitamin C and drink a lot of water while they're doing it, that's fine. I don't think it's going to hurt anything, but in terms of being a truly preventive or treatment for viral infections, it's really not.
Okay. Well, again, questions are welcome. You'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu.
The one other respiratory illness that people sometimes forget about as an adult is what used to be referred to as a whooping cough. Also known as pertussis, there has been an upsurge of that in adults, and there is now currently a recommendation for adults at least once in their adult life to get a booster on their pertussis immunization. And for many individuals in the office, what we've been doing is simply combining it with their once-a-decade booster on their tetanus. So if you haven't had a pertussis immunization, and especially if you have any contact with children, then it's probably a very reasonable thing for adults to get a pertussis booster, and it can be done in conjunction with the regular update of the tetanus.
So is that if, say you last time you got your tetanus shot, maybe it was just a couple of years ago, is there a recommendation that maybe it would be a good thing for you to get the pertussis, or is it okay for you just to wait for another, if it's another 7-8 years?
It's kind of a personal preference. There's no harm in getting the pertussis separately, but if you're going to be due for a tetanus relatively soon, you can get it all together in a single shot.
Okay. We have someone with a question in Mohammed, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I slid on the ice and landed flat on my back, and then my head kind of went back, and there was a sort of a cracking sound, which was probably the ice.
And we hope.
I didn't like to get the big giant goose egg, you know, like the kids get, but when I woke up this morning, as the day went on yesterday, I felt worse and worse, and I couldn't sleep last night because of the pain, and I woke up this morning and really can't move my head. But is that something that needs to be looked at, or is it just going to kind of go away?
The first question I would have, were you actually knocked out when you fell?
No, I was not unconscious.
Okay. It is pretty typical for people who bang their head significantly to have a headache and oftentimes a stiff neck the next day just due to the injury. If you think about it, even if you have a little hairline fracture in your skull, we're not going to put your head in a cast. So there really isn't any specific treatment for that. And in fact, what we're most concerned about is the inside part of your skull, which is your brain. So individuals who are having severe worsening headaches, nausea, vomiting, difficulty with their vision or speech, neurologically, if they're having trouble, they need to be seen. And what they really need is a CAT scan of their brain to make sure that they didn't damage anything. If you are otherwise walking and talking and functioning pretty normally, but just a little sore.
Yeah, just hurt.
Right. Then a cold compress to the area, some Tylenol, give it a little time, and it should gradually settle down.
Okay, great. Well, that's good news. My neck's kind of like there's like, I don't know, creaky noises in there when I turn my head, but that's all just the part of the probably muscle and stuff that needs to heal.
Correct.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
All right, very good. Thank you. And other questions are welcome. Again, the number here, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. So I guess if you had that kind of experience, I'm not suggesting that it was applied to this caller, but if you had that kind of experience, you could actually have a concussion if you hit your head hard enough?
If you hit it hard enough, you sure can.
Okay. And those are the kind of symptoms that you would be concerned about if you were experiencing that or somebody close to you was experiencing those things.
Right.
And then if so, you would say seek medical attention right away?
Yes. And in many instances, the critical period of time is that first 24 hours. And so having somebody available to simply observe how you're doing is a very reasonable thing. The old adage about, you know, don't let them go to sleep isn't really true. What we really want to know, if somebody's not conscious, are they asleep or are they truly unconscious? So in general, people who've had head injuries, we often frequently ask that somebody simply wake them up at night to prove that, in fact, they were just sleeping. The person who is truly unconscious after a head injury, that's a very serious major problem. They need immediate medical attention. Somebody who says, you know, I'm sleepy, but I can be awakened, then that's pretty normal.
Okay. On to other callers. Urbana, next, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah.
So that kind of advice is by far more useful and helpful than what we normally get when we call in to, for example, the health line run by our insurance company. Is there any facility for people to call and speak with an actual doctor instead of someone who will almost always tell you that you need to go to the hospital? Like, I've called with that a similar kind of question, and not called your show, called the equivalent of a dial-a-nurse type of thing. Mm-hmm. And they always default to, you should go to the hospital. You should get x-rays.
And the difference between a call-in radio show where I'm, quote, not practicing medicine, is I don't entertain any legal liability for the general medical discussion that we're having. When you call the dial-a-nurse, you are receiving medical advice, and there's legal liability associated with that advice. And to be honest, they're working on protocols that don't really allow for a whole lot of individualized judgment. Since there is a significant limitation with the amount of information you can gather from somebody over the phone, they, as you correctly point out, frequently default to, well, gee, if it could be bad, you should go to the emergency department. This is a situation where if you have a primary physician, you should be able to call their office and at least ideally speak to the physician's nurse who has access to your regular medical records, may know you well enough and feel comfortable enough to say, gee, you seem like a responsible person, and if we give you this advice and things aren't working out, you'll check back with us.
Okay, so I guess I understand the liability question, or the liability, the difference between liability and in the two situations. Are there facilities where we can get that kind of advice where they're not under those kind of liability constraints, where we would actually speak with a doctor or email a doctor instead of somebody who is just trained in a protocol?
I'm not aware of anything locally. There are probably, say, internet-based organizations that could answer, again, general medical questions. But once you start to form a legal doctor-patient relationship, the liability automatically exists. So there's going to be limitations to what people feel comfortable doing unless they already know you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. We have as our guest this morning in the studio Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor. He works at Carl in Urbana. And every other month he's here on the program on a Monday, and we call this Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that it's an open opportunity for you to ask questions. I always try, whenever we have physicians here, I always try to say, look, there's only so much we can do on the phone. There are times when someone needs to see you, but we try to answer questions on these shows, and I think we've done a pretty good job over the years. We've had a lot of doctors here on the program, and I hope we've helped people out and added to their understanding of what was going on with their health and the health of people in their family. So if that's you have particular health concerns, give us a call, and you can discuss it with the doctor. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. The next caller is in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to go back to whooping cough. If you have had whooping cough as a child, do you still need to be immunized as an adult?
The answer would be yes. Just as most kids these days get immunized for whooping cough, but what we have subsequently learned is that their immunity over time does in fact wane, and a booster as an adult to basically enhance that immunity again is in fact recommended.
Okay, well, specifically, I was 9 when I had whooping cough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now 85. Should I get the whooping cough shot?
The current recommendations are that beyond a certain age, you probably don't need to. So at this point in your life, you probably don't. What we would probably tell you, as we tell most folks over the age of 60, a shingles vaccination is a recommendation, and after 65, a pneumonia vaccination is, in fact, a recommendation. Routinely, then, an annual flu shot, and if you need your tetanus booster every 10 years, then that's fine, too.
Okay. Well, I don't think I'm going to come down with whooping cough, then.
We hope not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let us continue, and we'll next talk with someone in Mattoon. Line 4.
Good morning.
Yes, hi.
I have two questions. I read in the paper recently that people with an egg allergy could get this year's flu shot, that they weren't having problems with it. And I just wonder if this is true. And second question, I had a pneumonia shot 2 or 3 years ago and was told that I wouldn't need it another one for 5 years. And then I also heard... I'm over 80, that you wouldn't need one, period, later.
The question about egg allergy as it relates to the flu shot, I'm not aware of a recommendation that says folks with true egg allergies are approved for the use of influenza vaccination. Now, many individuals who think they're egg allergic probably aren't. They may have had some adverse reaction to some sort of egg product, but if they're not truly allergic, then it's probably not an issue. But I'm not.
They're still making the vaccine in the same way they have in the past.
Correct. And consequently, because they're using an egg-based protein to help produce the vaccination, then I'm not aware that any change in the recommendation has been made recently. As it relates to your pneumonia vaccination, there's a standard recommendation for folks to get at least one after the age of 65. Depending on what your other underlying medical conditions might be, some physicians do, in fact, recommend boosting it later, anywhere from 5 to 10 years.
So there's nothing to the five-year thing?
There's nothing automatic about it, no.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. And the next caller up will be Lafayette, Indiana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. What have you to say about zinc as a preventive for winter illnesses?
Oh.
For colds?
There have been some studies that suggested zinc, if taken immediately at the onset of a cold, might reduce the length of time that the cold was active. It didn't seem to be a dramatic difference. One of the forms of zinc had been promoted for this was in the form of a nasal spray, and subsequently the FDA found some folks who were having trouble related to loss of sense of smell as a result of using it. So there's been some question raised as to whether that particular form of zinc as a nasal spray would be continued to be used. There are folks who take oral zinc supplements, and if it's taken immediately at the onset of the cold, might potentially shorten it somewhat, but certainly it's not been anything dramatic in terms of symptom reduction, and it's not a preventative treatment. You just don't take it regularly and then not get a cold.
I hear from my pharmacist that the that the remedies contain a different form of zinc from the regular supplement.
That I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Might zinc, I read this somewhere, help restore a sense of taste or flavor in food?
I'm not aware of that as a touted benefit.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. On to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have just started in the last few months having burning feet. It feels like a floor burn when I rub my feet together. When I'm in bed, I rub my feet together. I can't help it. I'd like not to, but and then they, after two or three rubs, it begins to burn. It's really painful, and if I quit, then it quits. Can you give me any idea of what is causing this? I've never had it before.
Do you have any other underlying medical conditions?
Well, I have high blood pressure, cholesterol problems, and which are all under control, by the way, with medication. And I take medication for depression, and I think that's about it.
And are any of your medications new?
No.
Okay. And has there been any history of diabetes?
No. Well, I have been diagnosed as borderline diabetic twice. And both times I've been able to bring it under control, and right now I'm fine. I've never had it, but I have been warned.
Okay.
You know, and my weight is fine. It's obviously what I eat.
Okay.
It's not the weight.
So you have this burning sensation. Can you physically see anything odd or unusual about your feet?
No. No, and I look at them, and it just feels like there'd be blisters there.
Mm-hmm.
But no, when I examine them, I don't see anything.
Okay,
there's no mark.
The symptoms that you describe are fairly commonly associated with a condition referred to as peripheral neuropathy. When it affects both feet, the most common cause for that is diabetes.
Oh.
Now, there is a very long list of other potential explanations for people who have peripheral neuropathy, and there's a fairly complete set of evaluations, including some laboratory testing, that need to be done to sort that out. But,
uh-huh.
But if you statistically looked at what was the most common cause for people to have a peripheral neuropathy, it would turn out to be diabetes. So if you
don't want to have that,
and we don't want to give it to you either. But if you are due to see your regular physician for any of your chronic medical problems, this would be a very appropriate thing to mention and pursue some further evaluation.
Well, let me mention one more thing. I've had of course this is just 1 foot. I've had substantial injuries to 1 foot. But again, it's not 2 feet. I don't think it probably applies.
Right.
So. Well, I have an appointment in February, the first part of February, so I will bring it up.
I think that would be a very good idea.
Thank you very
much.
All
right. Thank you for the call. We are at our midpoint of this hour of focus. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is our guest. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And every other month he's here, we do the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And whatever questions you have, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And in fact, I have an email here from a listener who has two questions. First, when we talk about impaired immune systems, what exactly are we supposed to watch in our CBC report?
It would be unusual for major problems to show up on the CBC. Your CBC stands for complete blood count. It's going to take a look at your red blood cell count, which if low, people basically say that's anemia. It will take a look at your white blood cell count, which for most individuals is part of their immune system, but only one small part of their immune system. So people can have a dysfunctional sort of immune system and still have a normal CBC. If your immune system is, in fact, really severely depressed, it may, in fact, show up in your white blood cell count. But in most instances, what we're telling people is if you've been, say, under treatment with chemotherapy or radiation for some type of cancer, your immune system is probably going to be somewhat suppressed. If you have been on long-term cortisone, prednisone, steroid-type medications, you're probably going to have some degree of immune loss. If you're simply getting older, your immune system simply becomes less active as compared to when you were younger. And there are a number of other medical conditions and medications that can potentially impact how your immune system is functioning. And those are things that should be attended to when physicians and their patients, you know, discuss their overall medical care. Now, in terms of if your immune system is, in fact, somewhat suppressed, then avoiding potential infection is the major thing to do here. And then, if at all possible, treating the underlying condition and either taking care of the steroid medication, getting off of it if at all possible, trying to resume normal function is what you can do. But it's not all going to show up on a standard blood test.
The other question that the caller has, listener has, is regular body massage helpful in maintaining a healthy immune system?
You know, some of the benefits of massage have been increased local blood flow to the area. That's not a bad thing. Certainly, people who benefit from the overall relaxation associated with a good massage psychologically feel better, and there's certainly a direct relationship between our psychological well-being and our physical well-being. That's pretty much a two-way street. So to the extent that somebody says, as part of my taking care of myself, I periodically go someplace, relax, get a massage, that's probably not a bad thing to do. I'm not aware of any specific studies that have looked at the direct effects of massage on the immune system, but as part of a process of general well-being, I certainly think it's reasonable.
Okay. I'm sure that there are things that are promoted as immune system boosters, and that may indeed be one of the things that people think about at this time of year when they're trying to do what they can to fight off colds and flu that they might be exposed to. Is there anything that has actually been demonstrated to do that?
We're back to mom and her advice. Good diet, lots of sleep. You know, the things that basically keep the rest of your body in good shape is what keeps your immune system in good shape.
How about stress, either as a problem or stress avoidance as being something that's helpful? If you're under a lot of stress, is that going to have an effect on your immune system?
It can, in the sense that some of the stress-related hormones in our body aren't necessarily good for our immune system. When you think of stress, we think of increased cortisol, which in and of itself is one of those steroid kind of medications or chemicals. And so anything that you can do to reduce your stress is probably good for you.
Okay. Well, a call's here. Welcome to. We have a question. You have a question. Here's the opportunity to ask and get an answer. Again, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing that we had talked about, and we've touched on it a little bit, are vaccinations that are recommended for adults. And you've talked a little bit about three of them at least, the one for whooping cough that we're now recommending that adults get, and we're sort of folding that into the recommendation that every 10 years you should get a booster on your tetanus. You also talked a little bit about shingles and pneumonia. Are there other vaccinations that are now being recommended for Adele?
Those would probably be the basics for folks here in the United States. The once-a-decade tetanus booster, an update of your pertussis as an adult, the shingles vaccination after the age of 60, the pneumonia vaccination after age 65, and then the yearly flu shot. A number of these vaccinations are good for a long time, but the flu shot actually needs to be updated each year. As the flu strains change, they have to change the vaccination. But unless you are traveling to some, you know, far-off exotic place and need a specific immunization, these would be the basics. Now, some people, in terms of their occupation, if they have exposure to blood and bodily fluids, as they say, hepatitis immunizations would certainly be reasonable. A number of these things are actually included in the current childhood immunizations, things like hepatitis B. But there are some adults who, if they hadn't been immunized as children and they then, say, take up a new profession, like if you're going to be a policeman or a fireman and you might come in contact with accident victims, you'd like to update your hepatitis B. But otherwise, the tetanus, pertussis, shingles, pneumonia, and the flu shots would probably be the basics.
Okay, so with the hepatitis, unless you're a doctor, nurse, EMT, firefighter, police officer, probably you'd, and you're an adult that has never gotten that shot, probably that's not something that you need.
Probably not.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Genoa. Line number four right here. Hello.
I have to get a new doctor because they keep retiring on me.
Well, that means you're living a long time.
Yeah. And do I get a family practice doctor or do I get a internal medicine doctor?
I think that's pretty much up to you to decide.
I'm 60 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. Internal medicine physicians see only adult patients. Family medicine physicians will see adult patients and younger folks as well.
Okay.
So it's really a matter of sort of your personal preference or local knowledge of the physicians in your community, any particular medical problem or concern that you think might be unique that somebody might be able to address better. But either should be fine, but I would encourage you to have somebody. I think it's a good idea for physicians to work with patients that they know, and having a primary physician that you work with regularly, I think, is a good idea.
Well, I'm at that time where you look at the website and you go, well, let's see, you got all these different characters here. And, you know, you try to pick one out, and then you need to go see them and get an appointment for the appropriate time, and that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, and I think in that regard, you know, one of the better ways to do that is to simply, you know, ask either friends or family, you know, what do you know about so-and-so, and see. But in many instances, yeah, you need to go in and chat and find out how they sort of do things and how you'd like things to be done and discuss that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. There is a medical specialty. There are doctors who specialize in dealing with older adults. Mm-hmm. Is there some point where you think either because of an individual's age or perhaps because of various kinds of conditions that they may have that you might want to think about going from a family medicine doctor, mm-hmm. somebody like that, to someone who is a geriatric medicine specialist?
Well, the geriatricians are either family physicians or internal medicine physicians who then took a fellowship and spent basically more time taking care of the what we consider to be sort of the old and frail patients. And again, it's kind of a matter of personal preference. There are some very spry 90-year-olds still running around who say, you know, why should I go see somebody else? And, you know, to the extent that they're happy with whoever their primary physician is, then that's probably fine. In other instances, either the patient or the physician may say, you know, you have so many chronic medical problems that having somebody take more time to go through all of these things with you is a reasonable thing to do. But basically, the geriatricians are either internal medicine physicians or family physicians who took an additional year of fellowship to basically get more experience with just those frail elderly patients.
Okay. Well, again, other questions, welcome. We have about 15 minutes left here with Dr. Jeff. If you want to talk with him, you can give us a call. Something I want to ask you about, because it's been in the news a little bit lately, is aspirin. Now, just recently, there have been some studies that suggest that taking aspirin over a long time, a long period of time, can reduce the risk of some cancers. And there have been other benefits suggested, cardio benefits, of taking a very small dose of aspirin. And at the same time, though, I think it's interesting that sometimes when people talk about aspirin, they say, well, you know, actually, if somebody came along today and proposed that aspirin be introduced, it wouldn't be available over the counter. It would only be available by prescription. So that makes you wonder, okay, what are the pros and cons, and should people be careful when they hear this advice that says a daily aspirin, even a low-dose daily aspirin, is a good thing?
You're correct about aspirin being a potentially very powerful medication depending on the dose at which it's taken and the duration with which it's taken. And in all likelihood, had it come to market, it probably would have had to get FDA approval. Mm-hmm. And like some of the other anti-inflammatory agents like ibuprofen and naproxen, might be over-the-counter in small doses, but you'd need a prescription then for bigger doses. So a lot of the studies are hard to compare because they used different amounts for different lengths of time in different patient populations. So in general, the low-dose daily aspirin for cardiac patients is primarily aimed at the platelet effect. Platelets are little sticky substances in our bloodstream that help form clots. We want a certain amount of clotting to be available should we start bleeding, but we don't want clotting in our blood vessels where we could then have, say, a heart attack as a result of a clot forming. So in those particular settings of patients with cardiovascular disease, low-dose aspirin has been found to be helpful. The same rationale applies to the person who says, you know, I'm having chest pain, I'm thinking I'm having a heart attack, take an aspirin. You're trying to try and get the platelet effect of blocking clotting that might be occurring. Larger dose aspirin has been suggested for a variety of conditions, and a number of these have been noted over the years. One interesting one is folks on higher dose aspirin seem to have fewer colon polyps, and colon polyps can be a precursor to colon cancer. So there's been some studies done now looking at whether that should be a general recommendation because colon cancer is a relatively common problem. But the difficulty is, again, different doses, different patient populations, different lengths of time. There isn't any uniform agreement yet on how much aspirin for how long and in what age group is definitively shown to be beneficial. The downside of aspirin, like with other anti-inflammatory agents, is it can irritate your stomach. So there are people who will get ulcer-type problems because the medication ate a hole in the lining of their stomach, which is not a good thing. And then they'll end up with a bleeding ulcer from there. And anti-inflammatory agents can also cause sodium retention, and that then tends to cause fluid accumulation. And so then people tend to get their blood pressure raised if they're taking anti-inflammatory agents chronically. So there are some potential downsides. depending on what type of anti-inflammatory agent you're taking, problems with kidney function, liver function can occur in relatively rare instances. So just because something's over-the-counter doesn't necessarily mean that you can take as much as you want, as often as you want, and it'll be safe. You can basically, you know, take too much of anything and run into a problem. So people need to be careful about, you know, following the instructions on the label, and they also need to discuss it with their physician. In many instances, a fairly common problem is, you know, a physician will ask a patient, what medications are you on? And the patient will reply what prescriptions they're taking, but then leave out the six other over-the-counter things that they're also taking that may or may not be relevant to what's going on. Mm-hmm. So making sure that you report what it is that you're actually taking, prescription and non-prescription, to your physician, I think, is important.
Mm-hmm. Aspirin has this anti-inflammatory effect, and there are other over-the-counter pain relievers, thing, like ibuprofen does too. Tylenol does not, but these others do. So depending on what it is you're trying to get at, a choice of one or the other might be more beneficial. Say, for example, if you're having arthritis pain, or you've got muscle ache or strain, or you've got a sprain or something like that, taking Tylenol might help with pain relief, but the inflammatory thing, that's not going to help. And so that might, you know, you might want to choose one or the other. But if also you're somebody who has gastric issues, there's only so much ibuprofen you're going to be able to take. Is there really anything you can do, any form of the medication or anything that you can do to try to at least deal with that side effect?
A fairly common way of dealing with the potential gastrointestinal side effects of anti-inflammatory agents, if somebody needs to take them long term, is to put them on medication to lower the amount of acidity in their stomach. And that has been shown to be helpful. And medications such as Tagamet, Zantac, or the higher dose medications, things like Prilosec, are commonly used to try and help protect the stomach against the excess acid and irritation that's then added by the anti-inflammatory agent. Mm.
There seems to be a lot of interest in inflammation as a cause of disease or a contributor to the disease. And the thought is, you know, maybe if you could deal with that, then that might help in the treatment of some disease. Is that what is going on with the aspirin?
The inflammation in many instances is what causes the symptoms that we associate with the disease.
Wow.
And in most instances, we're trying to reduce the symptoms. But anti-inflammatory agents themselves will not necessarily cure any particular disease. And they are, in fact, for the most part, just symptomatic medications.
Okay. We have a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, sir, doctor. Is there such a condition as arthritis in the fingers?
Certainly.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Is there such a condition you might have arthritis in your fingers, on your hand?
Yes, sir. There is.
How would that present itself generally?
It would simply depend on the type of arthritis, and there are many, many different forms. The most common form, what we call osteoarthritis, is what many people refer to as just sort of wear and tear.
Mm-hmm.
And in those particular instances, the joints can be kind of stiff and sore.
Right.
And that's usually most noticeable after having not moved for a while. So many people will awaken.
That's when mine is most intense, when I awake from sleep.
Right, and that's because those joints haven't moved. Now, as a general rule, many people will who know they have this problem will stick their hands in warm water in the morning or take a hot shower, and by the time they're done, things have loosened up a little bit, and over the course of the day, it's a little less noticeable. And then the same process repeats overnight because the joints aren't being moved. Joints basically are more flexible when they're moved, and prolonged immobility actually causes them to stiffen and feel more uncomfortable. I frequently have people think of sort of a rusty door hinge. It's a little hard to get it going at first, but once you kind of break it loose, it'll swing pretty easily until it sets again and starts to rust. So in this particular instance, this is a fairly common occurrence just related to age. And what people do about it simply depends on how much trouble they're having. Going back to the mechanical things like moist heat will often be helpful. Moving them is helpful. If somebody says, I need something for pain relief, again, the acetaminophen/Tylenol type things can be helpful.
Okay.
Or anti-inflammatory agents are sometimes useful. You just have to sort of trade or at least be aware of the potential risks and benefits of chronic medication use.
Thank you, Dr. Jeff.
All right. Thank you for the call. And again, so we got about 5 minutes or so. If somebody has a call, has a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe, again, it would be worth mentioning, as we are at this time of the year, people have colds, flu. They're going at looking for over-the-counter symptom relief. That's a good idea to read the label of the package, because you really should be careful about taking too much acetaminophen or Tylenol.
Right. And many combination, multi-symptom sort of cold and flu relievers frequently put a number of different ingredients in there. And if you're not aware that, your multi-symptom cold reliever already has a significant amount of acetaminophen in it, and then you're taking, quote, Tylenol on top of that, you're really getting a double dose of acetaminophen. And that can potentially be a problem, especially for people who have underlying problems with their liver already.
Yeah. So you just don't want to take too much, and make sure you know what's – if you're going to use one of those things, just take a look at it and see what it says is in there, and make sure you don't end up doubling up on something that
right.
Without really thinking about it. Maybe also you might look at those products and look at the various symptoms that they say that they will help with and ask, well, do I really need all that? Because you can get probably any of those things – individually, if you think that would help, as well as getting them all loaded up into one thing.
Not only can you get them individually, you can usually get them generically, and so it usually costs less.
Save a lot of money. All right. Let's go to Matt Toon, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment about the gentleman and the osteoarthritis. I've been afflicted with that problem for a long, long time, and my wife is very understanding, but she still doesn't think it's all bad, because I found out that doing the dishes in very, very hot water gives me a lot of relief at least 3 times a day, and I think I'm accomplishing something while getting relief.
I think that's a great comment.
Everybody's happy all the way around. Sounds pretty good.
Everybody's happy. I don't have a bill at the pharmacy, and it really works. It really does. I just kind of take my time and soak them, and it really helps.
I think you found a perfect solution.
Okay.
Good
I
thought.
I wanted to mention that.
Excellent. All right. We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left. Again, someone wants to call real quick. Talk to Dr. Jeff, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe we could, I guess, just remind people that when it's as cold as this and you're going to be outside, you really need to dress for the weather.
It is very, very important. Problems related to hypothermia are quite serious, so individuals need to plan their activities so that they can spend the least amount of time outdoors. And as the weather people on TV remind people, it's very easy to get frostbite in this kind of weather if you have exposed skin for any length of time. So covering up and getting back in as quick as you can is very important. And in that regard, making sure that you have, say, something in your car, an extra blanket or something, you know, if given the winter weather, you end up stranded someplace, yeah, the last thing you want to do is end up being really, really cold.
As recently as last week, I've seen people out jogging wearing shorts.
Ooh.
Now, not it wasn't yesterday or the day before. You know, I hope at this point they're not doing that. But I was
so
just,
too.
And this was more than one person. I was just amazed seeing someone run along in shorts. And well, I guess that's if you're moving, maybe
if
that's
you're running
okay.
Really fast.
But no, not me. All right, one more, McLean County. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a very quick question. I have a hard time with a cold, a very, very hard time, enough that when I get a chance, I'm moving south. But anyway, what I sometimes happen is when I get cold or like I, you know, didn't have a scarf one day, and I wear a scarf starting October, my throat has gotten kind of, like, I feel like the inside of my throat swollen. And what can I do to help that? I mean, aside from maybe taking some pain medicine or... If you feel like you're...
Well, you're correct. Cold, dry air in certain individuals can be pretty irritating to the upper respiratory tract. Making sure that you stay well hydrated, but the primary thing there is, as you mentioned, try and protect yourself from that very cold, dry air by wearing a mask or a scarf or something that's going to allow you to sort of preheat the air before it gets to you. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, there really isn't anything other than avoiding it that I know is going to be some type of treatment for that.
So there are no lozenges, there's no...
Anything that temporarily increases the moisture in the throat is certainly worthwhile,
okay.
Whether that's a, you know, a throat lozenge or just making sure that you're drinking plenty of water, either of those would be fine.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we're just about coming down to the point. We have about a minute or so left. Is there anything, any last little thing that you might like to mention to folks?
Well, I'm going to wish everyone a merry Christmas and a happy holiday, and I hope we find all of our listeners to be in good health.
Very good. Well, stay healthy. Drink your fluids. Get your flu shot if you haven't already. Wash your hands. Stay away from your relatives. You'll probably be in pretty good shape.
Certain relatives can give you high blood pressure, so you might want to be careful about those.
Oh, good point. Good point. Stress is not good. Relieve stress if you can. Thank you very much. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor at Carl Inn Urbana. He is here with us every other month on a Monday for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor.